Hi, David here, and welcome back to the channel where we're looking at life and spirit through the automatic writings of the early 20th century medium James Paget. In the last video, we looked at a message from Paget's grandmother, Anne Rollins, in which she explains more about her experience of the process of seeking divine love. She also tells us more about when she first met Jesus, including a description of his appearance. That was about a year after James Paget started writing these messages, but he still has recurring doubts about the material he is receiving, particularly the identity of some of those who write to him. The idea that his own family members might be able to spend time with Jesus and those remembered as his disciples just seems too much, let alone the possibility that they might want to use him as a medium themselves for the purpose of writing these messages. For James, having been brought up as a conventional Protestant Christian and married to Helen, a minister's daughter, this all just seems unlikely in the extreme. It is doubly difficult for him because some of the messages flatly contradict the traditional Christian teachings that have been familiar to him through his childhood and adult life. I think any of us can identify with the challenge that James faces here. I know I certainly can. Living in an even more skeptical age than James did, it's one thing to reach the point of accepting that it is possible to receive communications from friends and family in spirit. It's quite another to accept messages from people who have been in spirit for many centuries. Messages from friends and family can be tested against what we know of them, but when we listen to messages from people we have not known personally, what do we test that against? If the message is from a historical figure, we can test it against the known record of that person. But if someone is coming forward to tell us that the historical record is wrong or needs correcting, what do we test that against? So we can readily see the quandary that James faces. The difference, of course, is that he has his own personal experience of working as a medium and of knowing what it feels like for people in spirit to draw close. He also has the benefit of personal messages from people in spirit who are known to him very intimately and who give their own testimonials as to the identity of others who communicate with him. Despite this, he still feels a degree of uncertainty from time to time. The other challenge he anticipates, of course, is that having received these messages, he will be expected to do something with them. I suspect very few people would welcome being in that position. So on July 18, 1915, Paget received a striking succession of short messages from different people in spirit, all seeking to reassure him that those who present themselves in his writings are who they say they are. I'm not going to read out all of the messages because it would make for a very long video, but I will include them in the transcript of this video that I upload to my Medium account. So it won't strictly be a transcript, it will be a slightly longer read. The first person to come forward to communicate with James is Stephen, known to history as Saint Stephen or Stephen the Martyr. Stephen is remembered as the first Christian martyr, having fallen foul of the Sanhedrin, the Jewish council, and he features in the New Testament book Acts of the Apostles. Stephen begins by saying that he did die the death portrayed in the New Testament, and that Saul, who later became the Apostle Paul, was his persecutor. Stephen encourages Paget to persevere with writing the messages, despite the opposition and disbelief that might be encountered. Stephen points out that he knows full well what it feels like to be in this position, so sympathises with Paget. Stephen is followed by Barnabas, one of the apostles, who later worked with Paul among those Jews in Jerusalem who accepted Jesus' teachings, and more widely across what today we would call the Middle East and Eastern Mediterranean. Like Stephen, Barnabas encourages Paget to accept his role, trust in what he is given, and put his doubts aside. Barnabas is then followed by the disciple Thomas, who knows full well what it can be like to be prone to doubts when told about something that is beyond his personal experience and which seems impossible. When Thomas was told by other disciples that they had seen Jesus after his execution, his reaction was much like that of James Paget to the content of the messages he is receiving. So Thomas also encourages James to persevere, even as he sympathises with him. Then Luke comes forward, remembered to history as the writer of one of the four Gospels in the New Testament. Luke makes some interesting comments on the book he is remembered for. "I am Luke, the writer of the third Gospel, as it is called. But here let me tell you that in that writing are things that I never wrote and never believed to have any existence. I know that my gospel is considered one of the most authentic of the four, but in it, as contained in the Bible, are many errors and impossible declarations of the truth as declared by the Master. You must eradicate the errors and retain the truths, and this you will be able to do when you have received the messages from the Master and the epistles that we, the apostles and disciples, may write." Luke is under no illusions that Paget will find this easy, but reassures him that he will be given the strength and support that he needs. Luke's comment about his gospel being regarded as the most authentic is interesting because that would probably not be said today. There are four gospels, short books about Jesus' life, that sit at the beginning of the collection of writings we know as the New Testament. Traditionally, the gospels are placed in the order Matthew, Mark, Luke, then John. The views of biblical scholars vary over time. But these days, the general view is that Mark's gospel is the one that is thought to include much of the earliest material. When Luke gave this message to Paget, scholarly opinion was different. The next person to come forward is the religious reformer John Wesley, who doesn't say anything about himself except to affirm that he has come forward, to reassure Paget that he should press on because of the importance of the work. Wesley lived through most of the 1700s and was one of the founders of Methodism. Although Methodism became a separate religious tradition, it first started as a reform movement within the Church of England. On various occasions when Paget writes, people who were religious reformers while here on earth come forward so as to press on with the task of trying to correct the misconceptions and errors that persist in favour of sharing their actual experience of life and spirit. After Wesley has said his piece, people known personally to James come forward in an attempt to support the words of these older, perhaps more unlikely spirits, trying to dispel Paget's doubts about the reliability of the messages he's receiving. So the next person to come forward is Paget's old law partner, Albert G. Riddle, who acknowledges that something seemingly incredible is happening, even as he wants Paget to accept it as true, saying, "If you doubt that you have been selected for this great work, I cannot understand the operations of your mind." This is pretty blunt in the way that only a good friend can get away with. Riddle's perspective, of course, is that of someone who sees exactly who is communicating with Padgett, knows what they say to be true, and has no room for doubt, but who, like everyone else in spirit, is also unable to do more than keep on emphasizing this. Riddle describes the work before Padgett as being a work that I am informed has never been successfully given to a mortal before to do. You certainly are blessed, and I am so thankful that it is so, and that you and I were friends on earth. This is an interesting comment. If the work expected of Padgett is so important, why has it never before been given to someone to do? There is an answer to this contained in some of the later messages, but it takes a bit of explaining and would take us off on a tangent from today's video. So I'm just going to flag it for the moment as a question we need to come back to, because it is an important and obvious one. As it turns out, there were previous attempts, but which didn't succeed as hoped. Padgett's next communicator is his grandmother, Anne Rollins, who expresses her own amazement at the reassurances he has been given. Interestingly, she says that the writings that you have received do not add one bit to my knowledge. But the thing that surprises me is that all these exalted spirits should come one after another and declare to you the fact that you have been chosen. Anne then goes on to reinforce what the others have said and is clearly trying to impress Padgett with a sense of wonder and an awareness of the seriousness and importance of what is being asked of him. Apart from his doubts as to what he is being told, in his moments when he contemplates the possibility that it is all true, James clearly feels daunted and has a sense of unworthiness for this task. Because his grandmother tells him, well, you are right, but you must not think of your own unworthiness, so believe. This is also quite blunt. James is asking, in effect, why me? Why have I been chosen? I'm not worthy. His grandmother's reply is basically to the effect, no, I know you're not worthy, but you have been chosen, so get on with it. She's not allowing him any wiggle room. Finally, as is nearly always the case when Padgett sits to write, the session is concluded by his beloved wife, Helen. It's a short message, as on this occasion he has already been writing for quite some time. I am here, Helen. Oh, my darling Ned, I cannot tell you how happy I am that all these great spirits should have come to you and testified that you are the chosen of the Master. Of course, I knew it, and you knew it before, but to remove all doubt that you might have, they came, and in such certain terms declared the fact. I know that you will have the power and love of many spirits to sustain you in your work, and think of the wonderful messages that you will receive. First, those of the Master that will excel all others, and then those of his various apostles and disciples. You will certainly be blessed with wonderful knowledge of the celestial world, and the power that will be exerted by your band will surpass any power that has been exerted before. And you will have the protection and sustaining power of spirits that will not permit any undesirable spirits or mortals to interfere with your work. I owe your own true and loving Helen. It's quite noticeable that Helen often concludes the writing sessions. James keeps going with writing the messages, despite his recurring doubts, because of his desire to hear from Helen, and because the messages from her and his grandmother and others have, by this time, become a familiar routine, the one that gives him hope. For those in spirit seeking to write through Padgett, his continuing doubts and puzzlement are a concern, because there is always the possibility that this will interfere with what they want to express, or lead him to do nothing with the messages, having received them. It's one thing to receive challenging messages from highly advanced spirits in the privacy and safety of your own home. It's quite another to go out into the streets shouting about it. What we see in the messages that we've looked at today is a concerted effort to reassure Padgett, and if not to clear his doubts altogether, at least give him enough motivation to continue with his mediumistic writing. So we have here a very clear example of people in spirit taking Padgett's thoughts into account and taking preemptive action to try and make sure that he continues to collaborate with them. They've all lived in this world too, so know the extent to which even the strongest and bravest might need a bit of help along the way. The only form that action can take is to try and persuade and encourage. All of us, whether we are on the earth or in spirit, have free will. So there is no question of Padgett's people in spirit being able to compel him in any way. From Padgett's perspective, all he can do to satisfy himself is to keep testing what they tell him, thinking it through to see if their words sit with him, and applying their teachings, especially the teaching to pray for God's love, to see if they make the difference claimed for them. As we'll see in future messages, they do. And this is all any of us can do when working with spirit. Keep testing, keep exploring, keep pushing, until we reach that point when we feel able to take the next step, building on what we now know, so as to learn a little more, always moving forward in love and sincerity, combined with a healthy personal discipline, or at least a willingness to persevere. If we want to work with people in spirit, this is essential. They are dependent on our cooperation to convey to this world accurately the knowledge and advice that is so badly needed here. And we need this because there are challenging times ahead, both collectively and individually. Individually, of course, those challenging times can come on the day we die, whatever challenges we might have faced while in this world. So the more we can learn from people about spirit and making the best use of our time here, the better. In the next video, we're going to look at a couple of messages given in November 1915. The first from James's grandmother, Anne, correcting the traditional teaching of unpardonable sin. And the other from Helen, looking at how people in spirit care for babies who die as a result of miscarriage or abortion, or who die very young, and whether there is any scope for a continuing connection between mother and child. So I hope you'll join me for that. In the meantime, if you've enjoyed this video, please do click the like button and subscribe to the channel if you haven't already, as it does help to introduce it to others. In the meantime, thank you for watching, and I'll see you soon. Take care.